This is an uprising against smug elites. Smug elites. So they're the villains, and the opposite is America. Because America is now one big gay disco.
Yes, yes, I am.
That's not evil. Being hostile to all mankind and subversive is not evil.
Well, I have to say that because St. Paul said the Jews are enemies of the entire human race. They are.
What do you think of Jordan Peterson?
Did you see the video about where he said I can't do it?
Adam, I'm trying to do you a favor.
You're fighting for the gay disco.
Don't make your ignorance normative for the rest of us.
Don't use those kinds of slurs.
You're fighting for the gay disco.
What? There are no slurs here.
Die for the gay disco. This is an uprising against smug elites. Smug elites. So they're the villains, and the opposite is America. Because America is now
definitely our most requested guest, Dr. E. Michael Jones, a man who needs no introduction.
I mean, it is. That's what they pay the Rockefeller Foundation to do.
You're not supposed to know what I just told you.
They didn't know about this. They didn't know what we know now.
Is there any argument you can use to wake them up?
Yeah, I think God had a plan for your life.
Well, you'd be jerking off every curvy piece of driftwood you saw at the beach.
Don't like
disco. Maybe you would.
And you're consistently refusing to talk about pornography.
Pete Buttigieg seems to be the exhibit A of that process.
Yes, yes.
Because you think that the anus is a sex organ, don't you, Pete?
Richard Spencer hands out spears and he says, charge the machine gun nest.
Dr. Jones. Sorry.
Not all of the heads of the Federal Reserve were Jews, but after a certain period of time, that seemed to be the case.
Hello and welcome to another episode of EMJ Live. Beautiful spring afternoon in South Bend, Indiana. Today, I'd like to encourage you to continue your Lenten observance of prayer and fasting and almsgiving in anticipation of Easter Sunday, which is 2 weeks away. Actually, Good Friday is 2 weeks away. In order to prepare us for the Good Friday celebration, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops just issued a statement warning us not to listen to the Gospel of St. John when they read it from the pulpit this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Because if you listen to it, you may contract anti-Semitism. Now, this is my statement of the situation, but let's listen to what they have to say. This is an article in The Pillar. The U.S. Bishops Conference announced recently that it will require a pastoral note on anti-Semitism to be placed in worship aids and pew missals ahead of all Good Friday Passion narratives beginning this year. The new requirement was announced last year in a memo from the heads of the USCCB Committee on Divine Worship and Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs to publishers of missals and worship aids. Notice of the memo was also included in the Committee on Divine Worship's January 2024 newsletter, which noted that the conference has previously provided guidance on homilies and similar statements for the Good Friday Passion in the 1990s and 2000s. The goal of the statement, the newsletter said, is to, quote, help ensure that the proclamation of the Lord's Passion is not misused to promote anti-Jewish sentiment. Wait a minute. Stop. Stop. We just had a significant shift here in nomenclature. Wait a minute. Are we talking about anti-Semitism or are we talking about anti-Jewish sentiment. Is there a difference here? Of course there's a difference here. The Gospel of St. John is not anti-Semitic because it does not refer to racial determinism or the race of Jesus Christ or the race of the Pharisees who were trying to kill him. But the Gospel of St. John is anti-Jewish. It is anti-Jewish. There is no way to get around the fact that it is anti-Jewish, and the Jews know this. And they've hated the Gospel of St. John for 2,000, well, whatever it is, 2,000, so close to 2,000 years now. Just to give you a little bit of contextualization, there was once a professor at Notre Dame by the name of Rabbi Michael Signer, whose academic qualifications were non-existent. He co-authored a number of articles, maybe three articles, which in academic terminology means he didn't do anything, didn't write anything, no books, nothing. Well, what was the guy's purpose there? What was his goal at Notre Dame, as a professor at Notre Dame? His goal, coming from his own mouth, I heard him say it, was to make sure that Notre Dame did not use the Gospel of St. John during Good Friday services. The Jews have not stopped doing this. This is one of their major projects. And if they think that the Catholic Church is going to go along with this, well, it looks as if they succeeded, which is why we're doing this podcast. Anti-Jewish sentiment is at the heart of Christianity. There is no way around it. We're talking about the battle between the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ as their Messiah and the Jews who killed him. There is a battle there. It will never go away. It's going to be there until the Jews convert, because the Church of Jesus Christ is not going to perish in the meantime. All right, then we go back. Next sentence here. The note on anti-Semitism. Oh, well, wait a minute. We're back to anti-Semitism now. Well, make up your mind, fellas. Is it anti-Semitism or is it anti-Jewish sentiment? The note on anti-Semitism, which is available in both English and Spanish, reads, quote, "The passion narratives are proclaimed in full so that all see vividly the love of Christ for each person. In light of this, the crimes during the Passion of Christ cannot be attributed in either preaching or catechesis indiscriminately to all Jews of that time, nor to Jews today." How many times have I told you that there is a difference between all Jews and the Jews, or all Jews and the Jewish people? When has the Catholic Church ever taught that the Blessed Mother raised her fist and shouted, "Crucify him," at the foot of the cross? That means that not all Jews were guilty of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Obviously, every single Jew who had acknowledged Jesus Christ as the Messiah was not complicit in his crucifixion. Well, who was then? The Jewish people. The Jewish people. As I said many times before, the Jews and all Jews are two different categories. Why are we getting this stupid statement announcing what is so obvious? What is the obvious statement here? It comes 1 Thessalonians 2, as I said many times. The Jews are the people who killed Christ and are enemies of the entire human race. That's St. Paul. It's never going to go away. It's in Scripture. Okay, the Jews are the people. What do we mean by the people? This is an organized political entity. It's like the Chicago Bears. It's like the Republican Party. It's a group of people organized for a specific purpose. It was called the Sanhedrin back then. Now it's called major Jewish organizations. There has always been a formal Jewish entity that mobilizes the Jewish people for its ends. And one of its main ends was the killing of Christ. And to this day, it has been the rejection of Logos and the promotion of Jewish revolutionary activity, from abortion, which is a fundamental Jewish value, we know from 400 Jewish organizations, to Zionism. which is now responsible for the deaths of 20 to 30,000 innocent women and children in Gaza. That's the group we're talking about here, okay? And they are the group that killed Christ. The Jewish people, this statement continues, should not be referred to as though rejected or cursed, as if this view followed from Scripture. Well, let's eliminate the curse. No one ever said the Jews were cursed. I have never heard that in my entire life. I have never heard that come out of the mouth of any Catholic. But it says here, should not be referred to as though rejected, as if this view follows from Scripture. Sorry, folks. The rejection of the Jews is deeply rooted in Scripture. If you don't know about it, okay, if the committee here, NCCB, is listening, I'm going to read a little passage to you that may bring this home to you in a particularly acute way. Matthew 21. Verse 23, it's called the parable of the wicked husbandman. Listen to another parable. There was a man, a landowner, who planted a vineyard. He fenced it round, dug a wine press in it, and built a tower. Then he leased it to tenants and went abroad. When vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his produce. But the tenants seized his servants, thrashed one, killed another, and stoned a third. Next, he sent some more servants, and this time a larger number, and they dealt with them in the same way. Finally, he sent his son to them. "They will respect my son," he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come on, let us kill him and take over his inheritance." So they seized him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to these tenants? They answered, "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will have to deliver the produce to him when the season arrives." Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the Scriptures it was the stone rejected by the builders that became the keystone? This was the Lord's doing. It is wonderful to see. I tell you, when the kingdom of God will be taken, I tell you then that the kingdom of God will be taken from you and given to a people who will produce its fruits." When they heard this, the chief priests and scribes realized he was talking about them. But though they would have liked to arrest him, they were afraid of the crowds who looked on him as a prophet. Okay, that vineyard has been taken away from the Jews. It's been handed over to the people who are now the followers of Jesus Christ. This is the parable. The term we use for this parable is called supersessionism. We Catholics are the children of Moses. The Jews are no longer the children of Moses. They are no longer the chosen people. If they want to get to heaven, if they want to be saved, they have to follow the same route that everyone else follows, and that is they must be baptized. This is exactly what Peter told to them in the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles. Peter shows up in Rome. He's not afraid of the Jews anymore. He opens the dialogue by saying, "You killed Christ." The Jews are cut to the heart. They say, "What must we do to be saved?" And Peter says, "You must be baptized." That's it. It's the entire story. That's the good news. That's the gospel. And it's not going to change. Now, we have been involved in this struggle for a long time. We, talking about culture wars, and in particular, Robertson Jenness, who wrote an article in Culture Wars a few years back, about the bishops, the American Bishops' Catechism, which stated the Mosaic Covenant is eternally valid. So Jenness wrote the article saying this is heretical. Next thing we know, the bishops remove it from the catechism. And then they immediately say, "No, it had nothing to do with the article, blah, blah, blah." Well, you can believe that if you want. I don't think that's the case. What I'm saying here is, this provoked a crisis, okay, because the bishops now had to deal with their own catechism. Now, they put it to a vote, and the vote, when public, was inconsequential. When the vote was taken in private, the bishops overwhelmingly voted to remove that sentence, that heretical sentence, from the catechism, which means that the American bishops supported supersessionism. Even though Father Massa, who was the Catholic Jewish dialogue guy, met with St. Genis and said, no one believes in supersessionism anymore. It turns out when you leave the bishops alone in the privacy of the room, when you draw the curtain in front of the voting booth, the bishops came through and they said it's heretical and they supported supersessionism. Well, we're dealing with the same thing here. There's not a bishop within a mile of this document. Not within a mile. Okay? This comes out later on. There's a question and answer period. How did this pastoral come about? Okay, now the lady who's answering this question is a lady by the name of Rebecca Cohen. Oh, that sounds Jewish to me. She's a program and research specialist of USCC Secretariat for Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs. Now, either she's Jewish or she's a Jewish convert. Okay, so great, you're a Jewish convert. But the question is, why is someone like Cohen in charge of just telling the Catholics what they need to believe here? Anyway, this is what she says. Historically, the Passion Note originated with the Bishop's Committee on Liturgy, which back in the 80s recommended to be put into different aids. Over the years, there's not been any kind of enforcement or any type of expectation, so it wasn't always used. As it disappeared more and more, it's either go ahead, okay, they put it in. The Ecumenical and Religious Affairs Committee developed this note. They voted on it and then suggested it to the Committee on Divine Worship, which then voted on it and confirmed it. They had the final say. This is a completely bureaucratic document. There's not a bishop near this thing. Shame on the bishops for handing away their authority to a bunch of anonymous bureaucrats who are now going to impose Jewish thought control on the Catholic faithful by telling them not to listen to the Gospel of St. John. This is outrageous. There's no other word for it. So how does this continue? Okay. The church ever keeps in mind, we're back to the statement that you're going to read this in your missal, you Catholics out there, like the warning on a cigarette pack. Okay. The church ever keeps in mind that Jesus, his mother Mary, and the apostles all were Jewish. I didn't know that. As the church has always held, Christ freely suffered his passion and death because of the sins of all, that all might be saved. Have you heard this before? I have heard it many times. It wasn't the Jews that killed Christ. It was sinners that killed Christ. Well, wait a minute. Let's do the Venn diagram, okay? This is sinners. Okay, I wish I had a blackboard here. Okay, that's that circle there. It includes every single human being, all right, because we're all sinners. Okay, now let's draw the diagram, the Jews. Oh, well, according to this, that circle's over here, and there's no intersection between Jew and sinner. That's the only way this sentence makes any sense. It's ridiculous. What are you telling me, that no Jew is a sinner? Oh, well, then if Jews are sinners, well, then they did participate in the killing of Christ. Oh, and beyond that, they had a special role because they were the ones that forced Pilate to do it. We know this. You can't tell us any other story here. Why is the Catholic Church being infiltrated by people like Rebecca Cohen? Why is that happening? I'll leave that for another discussion. Again, one of the most important ways of addressing anti-Semitism right now is ensuring that there is a clear commitment to the teaching of Nostra Aetate on how we understand Jews and Judaism. That's a starting point which helps us to be a springboard to confront anti-Semitism. That's Rebecca Cohen again. A springboard to come. Well, wait a minute, Rebecca. Are we doing Are we talking about anti-Jewish sentiment or anti-Semitism? Okay, we're back to anti-Semitism now. And as I've said many times before, it was never defined. It's mentioned in Nostra Aetate. The Catholic Church condemns all forms of anti-Semitism. All right, but what's it mean? If you had asked the Council Fathers at that point, go down the line, they would have all said biological determinism, anti-Semitism is racism, which is obvious and totally stupid. You can't have anti-Semitism as a factor in the battle between the Jews who killed Christ and the Jews who accepted him as the Messiah. They're both the same DNA group. That makes no sense. It didn't make sense until 1871 when the term was created as a way of avoiding religious terminology. So again, all right, you want to do that? You want to keep quoting Nostra Aetate? Then do us all a favor and define anti-Semitism. Otherwise, don't burden the conscience of the Catholic people with these ridiculous statements and ridiculous prohibitions. Looking broadly, okay? Again, this is the question with asking Rebecca Cohen. Looking broadly, what do you think is the important message for Catholics to understand their role in combating anti-Semitism? Wait a minute. Who said we're involved in combating anti-Semitism? How did Catholics get dragooned into carrying water for the ADL? How did this happen? Okay. How can a Catholic think about Israel? We're getting a little relevant here. How can a Catholic think about Israel and foreign policy in the Middle East and also the troubling sin of it's a sin? When did this happen? When did anti-Semitism become a sin? And when are the Catholics guilty of committing this sin? When did this happen? Is it a sin to criticize Jews? Is it a sin to say the word Jew? Do I have to go to confession and say at the bless me, Father, for I have sinned? I said the word Jew 3 times this week. What are we talking about here? How is this creeping into the discussion here? What are the ways in which Catholics can think through these things? Okay. Well, this is what Rebecca says. Most political questions that would actually be handled by a different office than ours, Office of International Justice, Peace. So, okay, I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, but I think one of the major items in terms of where we are relationally with the Jewish people is to understand how Jewish people understand themselves. For many, the state of Israel is part of their identity in one way or another. That's something to be respected. And it's something the Commission for Religious Relations for Jews has called us to respect. Oh, okay. Okay, we have to respect the state of Israel. We have to worry, agonize over the fact that we may have said the word Jew in a way that Mr. Greenblatt really doesn't like. And maybe we should go to the confession about, because it calls it the sin of anti-Semitism here without even defining anti-Semitism. But on the other hand, when it comes to Israel, which is committing not only sins, but crimes against humanity in Gaza on a daily basis, where the women and children who weren't murdered by F-16s with American bombs in them, flown by Israeli pilots, when their buildings collapsed on them, those children that survived that, who are now starving to death, because the Israelis are blocking humanitarian aid. Oh, we don't talk about that. Oh, that's another office. We're not going to talk about that. Okay. This is outrageous. This is outrageous. I'm sorry. I'm ranting more than usual here because this is so outrageous. Someone's got to call a stop to this. This cannot go on. That's my rant. Let's hear what you have to say.
Okay, hello all. This is Mike Pajakis, Dr. Jones' assistant. Quick rules for those who are new. This is a call-in section of our program. Call-in is made via our Telegram channel. A link is in description for those who are on various platforms. In Telegram, I'll call on those who raise their hands. And then later in the stream, we'll read off text questions from the various chats. Try to keep questions on subject. Try to keep the one question at a time. Be respectful of everyone's time and do not forget to unmute yourself. Also, for those on Telegram, I've been getting some complaints in the chat about audio issues. It looks like Telegram has changed some of their settings, and I have everything maxed out on your end. So I was kind of caught off guard about that. Got to deal with whatever you can get. Rumble is going. Odyssey is going. So if you guys need to listen to Jones on a different platform, you can go there. Okay. I'm going to jump to Telegram here. See what we got first. Cypher Zone. Go ahead, Cypher Zone.
Hello, Dr. Jones.
Hello.
I want to ask you about the problems and the dangers of usury. In the region where I live, it's very difficult to acquire a piece of land, especially for newer families with zero or one children because of the high prices.
And where, tell me where you are. Where are you?
I'm living in Europe right now.
Europe. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I live in Portugal.
Okay, good. All right.
Usually, and the prices here, they are extremely high because we get a lot of money from outside the country.
Right.
So usually what couples resort to is to get a loan, get a mortgage, which is debt enslavement for at least 30 or 40 years. So what do you say? What should young couples do to face this? Is there another way of doing this? What can you say about it?
Okay, you're talking, obviously, Europe is a different situation than the United States of America. There's a lot more land here. Land used to be free here, and there's a limited number of land that's been limited for a long time in places like Portugal. So that's part of the problem. How do you deal with that problem? Well, there is no simple solution to this problem because prices are high because of usury. As soon as you allow mortgages, as soon as you allow people to borrow money, the price goes up because the people who are selling have an unlimited market. You can borrow and borrow and borrow, and that's the problem. How do you get out of that? There's only one way out of this problem, and you have to cancel the debt, and that's not something you can do. What happened here is that the Biden administration, the worst administration in American history, was smart enough to realize that student loans were choking the economy, and so they canceled the debt. What happens in countries like the United States is basically that you have very liberal bankruptcy laws, and these bankruptcy laws allow you to default on loans because that's the only way a country can survive is if they default on the loans. So the question comes down to, well, who gets that privilege? Not every had. Well, the rich and powerful. Donald Trump defaulted three times. He went bankrupt three times. And the people who do not have political power, like the people with student loans, they cannot do that. And so that was the Biden administration saw an opportunity and went ahead and seized it. So if you're asking me for some type of magic formula about how you can buy high-priced property in Portugal without going into debt, I don't have an answer for you. I don't have an answer. Let me put it this way. There are various ways of borrowing. You can deal with a situation. The mortgage situation over here was tamed by the government so that the interest rates were held low for a certain period of time. That wasn't a floating loan. It was a limited loan. You had options. So if you have an option of a 10-year mortgage and a 30-year mortgage, you should always go with the 10-year mortgage because you will pay, it will be cheaper and you will pay it off in less time. It's that simple. It's just a problem that has never gone away. It has never gone away. And the way that people dealt with it over here was basically ethnic solidarity. It was that simple. You had ethnic groups who come over here. They had colonies here. They would create their own neighborhoods, which meant that there were everyone but a certain group of people was excluded from that neighborhood, which meant that you couldn't have big capital, people with big money coming in there. It was only ethnic immigrants, and you had associations, savings and loan associations, that would allow that to happen. The exact opposite has happened with the European Union. So Portugal, in this regard, is like it was an ethnic neighborhood. It was a group of Portuguese lived there, okay, and nobody else lived there. And there were certain countries that had rules where only the people of Portugal could buy property. That's all gone. The same thing happened in the United States of America. Basically, what the United States does is they break down all ethnic barriers so the capital money can reach wherever it wants to go. And so these people will come in, the wealthy people will come in and buy up all the choice properties, whether it's in Portugal or whether it's in Indiana right now. It's the classic example I've given is Mackinac Island. It's a tourist site. It's an island right in the Straits of Mackinac. They don't allow cars there. It's a pretty place. And there are people who live there all year round, who have lived there for a long time. The millionaires come in, they buy up all the choice property, and then in the name of preserving ecology, they don't want these tracks, anyone building any more houses. So they get the houses, and the people who have children, where are their children going to live? Where are their children going to buy a house? They can't do it. They have to migrate. The same thing happened with the coast of Maine. The lobster fishermen can't live on the coast anymore. They have to live 100 miles inland with all the travel because the rich New Yorkers bought up the entire coast. This is no consolation to you if you're coming to me for a magic pill here or formula that's going to solve this problem. I'm just saying it's a big problem and there's no simple solution to it.
Okay, Professor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Interesting. Prices are high, prices are absurd, but there's nobody living in it. For example, I live in a village of 2,000 people, so it's a small village. It's very small, it's the middle of the country, but it's absurd. The prices are very, very high.
Same thing happened in Michigan. We were staying in Manistee. There's a whole new development there. This is one day after Labor Day, which is the end. Still hot, still nice for swimming. No one's there. No one lives there. All the people, I assume there are people in Chicago who have money. They bought them up. They don't live there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's how it is. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Cypher. Let's go next to Brendan Burke. Go ahead. Wait a second. There it is. Go ahead, Brendan. And don't forget to unmute yourself. Are you there, Brendan Burke? Click the unmute button in the middle of your screen if you can hear me. I think we might have to go on to somebody else. Brendan's not unmuting or something's going on. Alejandro Herrera. Go ahead, Alejandro.
Hello, Dr. Jones.
Hello.
It is always a pleasure. I wanted to ask you for an advice because, well, this year we have the U.S. elections and also we have the Mexican elections. And I don't know if you found out, but we have a Jewish candidate, a woman called Claudia Sheinbaum. And she's, of course, sponsored by George Soros, and she just had a paid visit of Larry Fink. You know this
right.
Globalist
right.
agenda. If you have any advice for us, because we don't, I always watch your show and I have many of your books. I know how to address the anti-Semitic issue and the Jewish problem, but for my fellow Mexicans, how can we take this new 6 years coming? Because what we know is that she's going to win.
Well, okay, now you're talking about another big problem, the corruption of the electoral process. We have the same situation in the United States. Which Jewish group do you want to vote for? You can only vote for Jews in the United States of America. So which Jew are we going to vote? You want to vote for Biden's minion again? 457 Jews are running the Biden administration. Do you want to vote for Trump's Jews? Trump just said, told the Israelis, finish the job So more genocide. What type of choice is this? We don't have a choice. We have to come up with a political solution here to this problem, and we don't have it right now. We just had Kristi Noem, governor of South Dakota, made it illegal to criticize Jews in the state of South Dakota. There are 357 Jews in South Dakota. Why are you passing this law? Well, because you've got a pretty face and you want to be the next Sarah Palin. So you want Trump to choose you as vice president. Every single leader here betrays their own people to curry favor with the Jews. This is the fundamental political problem in the entire world right now. And how are we going to vote for it? Well, let's not just be totally pessimistic. There are some signs of change. George Galloway just got elected in England, the riding of Rochdale. George Galloway is a ferocious opponent of Israel and Israeli genocide. This was a total blow to the standard party system in England as well. Same issue. Tories, Labour, they're both in the pocket of the Jews. And so the people in this riding voted. He got six times as many votes as the next candidate running against him. And that wasn't even a Tory or a conservative. So he got the current political system was completely sidelined in the riding of Rochdale. This is what's got to happen. There is one fundamental issue. Max Blumenthal just said that what's happening in Gaza is the fundamental issue of our age. It'll be like what the Jews claim the Holocaust was, World War II. It is the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is, do we have a political system that represents the people who vote, or is it always going to be Jew money that determines our policies? That's the fundamental issue. All I can do is say, find someone else. Don't vote for the Jewish lady who is being sponsored by Larry Fink. They do not do that. That's suicidal. She does not represent the interest of the Mexican people. Kristi Noem does not represent the interest of South Dakota. Now, George Galloway, it turns out that there's a big Muslim constituency in Rochdale, and that's what got him elected. So let's be a little bit subtle here. I know there are lots of people, lots of these Englishmen, they don't like what's happening in their country. I don't blame them, but let's understand what happened to this country. The Jews flooded every single European country with migrants to destroy their culture. Same thing happened in America. The blacks were used as proxy warriors of the Ford Foundation back then to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods in Philadelphia. Read my book, Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal's Ethnic Cleansing. You'll get more than you want to know about that type of stuff. But they brought the Muslims into England, and it turns out the Muslims don't like Jews even more than the English don't like Jews. This is God's hand. This is the cunning of reason, and we have to be open to this so that we don't succumb to pessimism, because there's going to be, God is in charge of human history, and we have to be open to the way he's working. So no, if you're asking my advice, don't vote for that lady.
Right. Thank you very much, you're Dr. welcome. Jones.
You're welcome.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on here, let's go to, Gave Bones, Mr. Bones. Go ahead. Bones, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can.
Thank you. Dr. Jones, in your book, The Monsters of the Id, you kind of examine the hypothesis that Hollywood productions in the horror genre reflected sort of an unspoken and sublimated fear that is predominant in society, but nobody wants to talk about. And I wonder if extrapolating that hypothesis into the current time, and if you were to update your book, how you would deal with the zombie apocalypse genre. Is that a reflection of the spiritual reality of people who are, for whatever reason, are not in a state of grace, who left the church or rejected the Messiah or joined a schism or a heresy, and they're walking dead, waiting to be resurrected in the confessional?
Yeah, that the zombie thing did come out. That was the Romero films out of Pittsburgh. What I forget the name of those films. Something with dead in the title. Anyway, they were, it was zombie films, and it came out of there. We have that now in the city of Philadelphia. You got zombies, drug zombies on the streets. We had this phenomenon in South Bend. There's a zombie march, or there was a zombie march in South Bend where people would dress up as zombies. I remember thinking, why are these people doing this? I remember watching them. They look grotesque. They're trying to make themselves look as grotesque as possible. And one of the most grotesque things that I saw was women who had kind of bloody doll parts kind of coming out of their shirts. I think this was an obvious reference to abortion. And so I think that you can't underestimate the power of the guilty conscience to, in terms of determining behavior. This was my thesis about Alien. It's about abortion. It's about the sexual liberation turning violent. And I think that the same thing is pervading this zombie movement. These are people who are, they're trying to externalize something. They're trying to externalize something about their souls. I think that's what we're talking about here. They feel grotesque, and they're trying to manifest that grotesque nature about the way they feel about themselves by making themselves look as grotesque as possible as a way of purging that. That's what you're externalizing, what's inside of you, as a way of expelling it from your soul. I think that's what's going on with the zombie march. And I think it's a function of people who don't have access to sacramental confession for whatever reason. And I'm saying that these manifestations have existed in America almost from its beginning. I'm talking specifically about the Great Awakening, 1740s, the 1740s in the Connecticut River Valley, which gave rise to Methodism. People like George Whitehead coming over here and preaching to these people. These people were rolling on the ground. That's where we got the term holy roller. They were frothing at the mouth. They needed some type of cathartic moment because the Protestantism that they were exposed to was not helping them. This was the transition point in Calvinism. It was the moment of the halfway covenant where they tried the Puritans initially had to be a saint in order to be a member of the church. You couldn't go to confession because it didn't have that sacrament. Because you were a saint anyway, you never committed a sin. And the man who understood the psychology of that was Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote the Scarlet Letter about that. This pressure builds up in these cultures to the point where you have to have some type of external expression of it. So in many ways, the gay pride march, that's a zombie march too. It's a different type of zombie, but you're talking about the same type of thing.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bones. We're gonna do one more calls here, and then we're going to jump to the various chats. So guys in Rumble, Odyssey, Cozy, start typing in your questions. We'll get to those shortly. Okay, one more. Let's try MV, our friend MV. Where'd you go? Hold on. There it is. Go ahead, MV.
Hey, Dr. Jones.
Hello.
I don't know if you covered it last week, but recently there's an effort to get rid of TikTok that's passed the U.S. House. It's going to the Senate. And of course, they're blaming the Chinese for it and saying it's all for protecting the data of U.S. consumers. That's baloney. There was a leak of a Jonathan Greenblatt conversation where he literally called it the TikTok problem. So as you might expect, all the senators are on speed dial and probably getting phone calls right now to censor TikTok, because it really turns out it's the only way that a lot of young people are finding out about things like Gaza. And I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, well, it's obvious government censorship of the internet. And now they're trying to use the Chinese angle. This is ridiculous. There's a funny movie out. I didn't see this movie, but the premise is so funny, I have to talk about it. Did you know the Chinese are trying to take over Hollywood? Well, wait a minute. Can the Chinese be any worse than the Jews and what the Jews have done with Hollywood? This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. It's not going to happen. And you need a fake enemy to disguise the real enemy. You hit the nail. You know what's going on. You hit the nail on the head. The Jews have always been trying to suppress free speech on the internet because they don't know how to control it. Jonathan, another thing Jonathan Greenblatt said was that we're losing the Zoomer. Is it the Zoomer generation or Generation X? Anyway, the young people, he said, we're losing them. That's despite millions and millions of dollars get spent. Daytime, morning, local TV in South Bend, Indiana. There's a store, an ad about help us fight anti-Semitism. This is ridiculous. Who the hell watches morning news in South Bend, Indiana? Why is the ADL wasting its money with people who, this is a sign of their hysteria. We are at the end. The empire is starting to crash and burn. And whenever the world starts to fall apart, people go crazy. And the people who go crazy the most are the people who rule us and have the most to lose. And that's why you're seeing this hysterical moral panic about TikTok.
That's what I thought right before the election too. Thank you, Dr. Jones.
You're welcome.
All right. We're going to jump to the comments and questions here in chat. And who we can start with? SS Tiger. Who was Jew Sidney Shapiro neutralized Chinese citizen related to Ben Shapiro? He's kind of phrased it odd. So who is Sidney Shapiro? What's it have to do with China? And was he related to Ben Shapiro?
No, you're confusing. His name wasn't Shapiro. Now I'm stuck. Who was the guy? The name is an American from South Carolina who was in the army. Now, why am I drawing a blank here with the name? He was in the army right after World War II. He learned Chinese, goes over there, and basically defects to the Chinese, becomes a member of the Chinese Party. He's a Jew. The only non-Chinese member of the Chinese Party, he rises to the top of the party and has a leading role in the Cultural Revolution of 1966. You can see him there in his Mao uniform, waving the little red book, cheering people on. He was arrested, and it's an incredible story, and I am drawing a blank.
Sidney Rittenberg,
yes, thank you. That's the guy. So look up Sidney Rittenberg, and you'll find a really interesting story, and it's kind of the beginning, the thin end of the wedge. There were lots of Jews involved in communist China, in the Chinese, but he was the one who really rose to the top. Fascinating story. There's a video, a YouTube documentary on his life that's worth following.
Okay, next question here. Beach Tao on Cozy is asking, should we abolish Israel or should we ban all Jews to Israel?
Who's the we here? You and me?
Anyone.
We are... Look, the one thing that the Nazis and the Zionists agreed on is that the world would be a better place if you got rid of all the Jews in Europe and sent them someplace else. And the Zionist argument, beginning with Herzl, was that if you give them their own country, they'll act responsibly and they won't always be subverting your institutions. Well, that has failed. I'm sorry. That idea is gone. So there's, if you ban them all to Israel, maybe it would be better. Maybe that's not completely the problem. Maybe the problem is that the United States keeps supplying them with weapons and allows them to keep killing Palestinians. If the United States cut off all aid to Israel, if the United States had never recognized Israel, the world would be a different place. But this was the beginning of Jewish control of our culture, and now they have total control of our foreign policy. And we are standing by watching this genocide take place and no one's doing anything about it. Well, wait a minute, there are apparently airdrops. The United States is dropping aid because, you know, but I mean, it's a drop in a bucket at this point. So the solution to this problem is not to send the Jews to Israel, because, or if you send them there, don't give them any money. Maybe that would solve the problem. But under these conditions, no, that's not the solution to any problem. We've proven, the Israelis have proven that.
On Rumble, USMC9 asks, do you believe Putin is a good Christian?
Now, who am I to judge? Who is he? Ask me if he's a Christian. Yes, I think he's a Christian. Okay. The bigger point is Russia is now a Christian country. It's not the Soviet Union. Russia is not the aggressor in the war in the Ukraine. The Russians can talk to people, but they can't find anyone to talk to. So, but don't ask me to testify whether someone's a good Christian or not.
And then he had a follow-up question here. It's a question. No man can forgive sins. No need for a priest to forgive me. I go right to God and ask for forgiveness. How the hell does a priest know the mind of God? So can you explain to this nice gentleman how it works?
I like this guy. He's not going to talk to any. I want to go to the boss here. I'm going to bust right in line. You guys are waiting in line. I'm going to go right to the front of the line, and I'm going to tell the boss, who happens to be God, how he should do it. Listen, you got to listen to me. What's this guy's name? What is this guy's name?
USMC9. So
USMC9. He won't even give us his name, and he's telling us, telling God how to run his, how to run the universe. This is crazy. Only an American Protestant could think this way. Or I don't even think the European Protestants think this way, whether there are any of them left. This is absolutely crazy. You think you have the right to tell God how to run his operation? No, you don't. God created the Catholic Church. Jesus Christ created the Catholic Church out of mercy for sinners. And you should be grateful that he created the sacraments as sources of grace. And you should be on your knees in front of this God, thanking him for what he did and saying to God, I will do it your way, God. Speak, Lord, your servant is listening. It's been turned around to, listen, Lord, your servant is speaking. This is crazy, absolutely crazy. The only way, the only person who can forgive sins is God. And if you want your sins forgiven, you do it God's way. And God created the church, and he created the sacrament of confession. And he said it specifically to Peter. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven. Whose sins you shall retain, they are retained. That's it. Be grateful that God has, out of his mercy, allowed you that. And stop acting as if you're Donald Trump. This is ridiculous.
There you are. There's your answer, sir. From Pepsi Enjoyer on Cozy, Dr. Jones, is your review on Emmanuel Todd's book available?
Yes, it's in the April issue of Culture Wars. Subscribe now, and you will be able to read the review.
CultureWars.com. Let's see. Skipped around here. One moment. Lost my place. I guess this works here. From Scuba on Rumble, what is the psychological effect of women being bombarded on images of Madonna with the child for centuries, and then being bombarded with pop culture Madonna? What about the men? No saints. So
what about the men? What?
It says men in a little comment at the end, no saints. So I think he's basically asking, like, for years and years and years, we have all these images that are religious, and then suddenly we have these images that are pop culture, like a modern Madonna. Like, what has that done? The psychology of women.
Well, okay. I mean, first of all, let's talk about the Madonna. This is the great achievement of Italian art. And if you want to know the full story, buy my book, The Dangers of Beauty. This was one of the greatest achievements in human history, where suddenly the ideas of the incarnation finally sank down to the people of Italy, where they started to understand the implications of this. And they started, broke with the Greek models, broke with the icon, and started doing realistic portraits of mother and child, which inspired generations of women, that this was noble. It's not clear for the Greeks, much as I love the Greeks, that sexuality was noble. They sort of saw it as a compulsion that kind of ruled their lives. Read the Bacchae, and you'll find out what Euripides had to say about sexuality and female sexuality. Okay, it's dangerous. Okay, as soon as the women leave their looms and start running naked on the mountainside, worshiping the Dionysian god or the Asiatic god Dionysus, someone's going to die. And it turns out it was the king, the ruler of Thebes, Pentheus, died because his mother ripped him limb from limb. That's sexuality, according to the Greeks. That's not the Madonna and child, because the Madonna and child, Jesus Christ, the incarnational nature of Christianity, took human sexuality and raised it to the level which it deserved, which is epitomized by the fact that sex leads to a new life. And that is the basis of our society. So obviously the Jew can't leave this alone. So if you want to read how it went bad in the 20th century, read about the Jew Conviler showing up in New York, in Paris, and creating Picasso. And this was the beginning of the rampage against beauty that the Jews launched at the beginning of the 20th century, culminating in pop figures like Madonna, okay, who takes the name of the Madonna and then profanes it by being behaving like a slut in public. And that's just the beginning of a number of role models, okay? So who was the successor to Madonna? What was it? Was it Britney? No. Britney Spears, and then a good example is Miley Cyrus, who was a child star, had a kind of wholesome image because of Disney, and then to turn her into a slut, and then we have Taylor Swift. It just goes on and on and on. The industry, Hollywood, is forever creating role models, influencers, people you're supposed to emulate. And they're all the wrong kind of people, because the Jews control it, and they control it for their profit and not yours. The people who painted, the Italians who painted the Madonnas, did that for your benefit, probably more than for theirs.
From Page Chronicles, what is EMJ's take on Rabbi Shmuley's, Botchet's daughter attacking Candace Owens for claiming Jesus is king? So what's your take on all that?
If Rabbi Shmuley didn't exist, Hitler would have to invent him. I can't think of anyone. I'm trying to rack my. But let's go back. Like Magnus Hirschfeld, that was actually the case. Okay, Magnus Hirschfeld. Apparently, Stu Peters got in trouble for talking about Magnus Hirschfeld. He's the Jew who's promoting homosexuality during the Weimar Republic. He's the Jew that basically put Hitler into power. That was when you're talking about book burnings, it was Magnus Hirschfeld's books at the Institute for Sexualforschung that they were burning, because he was promoting all homosexuality and all sorts of sexual decadence. Okay, now you got, wait a minute, they can't get away from this, can they? They can't get away from this. So now you have Rabbi Solomon Friedman, who's the owner of Pornhub. You have Al Goldstein. You have this whole group of Jews, and they're interested in sexual deviance. And now you got Rabbi Shmuley, who's got his own sex business with his daughter. This is, as Candace Owens said, this is disgusting. And yet, so it's bad enough when this guy thinks he's going to make a living by corrupting the sexual morals of other people. And now he's going to be the commissar that's going to take Candace Owens out and shoot her. Apparently, he's just filed a lawsuit. This is Rich, the rabbi.
Did he really?
That's what I heard. It's the latest thing. So don't quote me on it. Okay. I'm just telling you that this type of thing you can read if you go on the internet now. Whatever it is. So who does Candace Owens think she is? Who does she think? Doesn't she know that she has to get the approval of some thug like Rabbi Shmuley before she can open her mouth in public? This is outrageous. I see this as the cunning of reason. God gave us Rabbi Shmuley to understand how deeply disturbed Jews are. He's the influencer that we need to watch. This is the guy who took control of Robert F. Kennedy. This is the guy who thinks he can rule your life, ruin your life. If he has the right as Rabbi Shmuley. If you say something he doesn't like, he has the right to ruin your life. I mean, this is a gift from God. That the veil has finally fallen from these people. All the goodwill we had toward Jews is being destroyed on a daily basis between Rabbi Shmuley and Benjamin Netanyahu and genocide in Gaza and abortion is a fundamental value. We are being presented with these gifts from God, and he is asking us to do something about it. Do something about it. Okay? And unless, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about removing these people from positions of authority in our culture. No one like this should have any authority whatsoever. Now I'm talking about Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan Greenblatt should have no authority whatsoever in saying what goes down on the internet. None of these people should. We've given them benefit of the doubt for too long. They have to be excluded from any type of position of power, whether it's cultural or whether it's political.
All right,
that's
a little bit after six. More.
One more question.
What's a good one here? One more question. I guess from Cosmos on Cozy asks, will there be a mass conversion of the Jews? A recently popular former FSSP priest named James
Bob Sengenis has gotten into an argument with Father Maudsley. He claims that there's no scriptural justification for saying that there's going to be a mass conversion of the Jews. This can be problematic because I think one of the people who felt this way was Ratzinger. Even as Pope Benedict, he was promoting this idea, basing it on some obscure German mystic from the Middle Ages. And I personally think it was simply a way of avoiding the confrontation that we all have to take right now. He said there was no mission to the Jews. Well, do you hate Jews? Is that why you do this? You want them all to go to hell because you don't want to tell them to be baptized? It seems, I've heard Jews tell me that, you know, that this is the worst form of anti-Semitism, is to basically say that Jews shouldn't convert, so they all go to hell. Okay, that's not it. They need to convert, but it seems to me there's no good. It's not something miraculous that happens. It happens because of discussions like this that we're having here now. We have to, in our own way, do what Peter said when he went to Jerusalem. You killed Christ. When you say that, they'll be cut to the heart. And then they'll say, what must he do to be saved? And then you say, you have to be baptized. So that was a mass conversion. 5,000 Jews converted on the spot. That's the way I see it. I don't see anything magical happening all at once at the end. I don't see it.
Well, there you are. Thanks again, everyone. This has been another episode of EMJ Live. Once again, every Friday at 5. If you're not already, please subscribe to Culture Wars Magazine at culturewars.com. All of Dr. Jones' books can be found only at fidelitypress.org. Do the subscription to Telegram, Cozy, BitChute, Gab, Odyssey, all those things. I have no announcements. Dr. Jones, final words.
Yes, happy Lent. And don't worry, I personally absolve you from any sin you may commit when you listen to the Gospel of St. John. It is not anti-Semitic. It's anti-Jewish. It's not anti-Semitic. And we don't have any choice in the matter. So God bless you. Have a happy Lent.
God bless, guys. See you next week.